One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel. I am the editor of the TLS. I'm back from a disgraceful holiday, a mere amateur vacationer in the presence of Thea Lenarduzzi. Of course, Thea, hello.
Such a shame that you see holidays as disgraceful.
Yeah, I know. There's probably some psychological thing we should maybe pause to explore at some point. I wanted to mention
About to tell me your other holidays?
No. That tweet that was sent to us. It was a sign in The Hague.
Yeah, outside a cafe.
I want to credit the person who sent it to us because it made me laugh out loud.
Tracy.
Well, thank you. Tracy Henderson, you may have seen this already. Just walking around The Hague and stopped in my tracks by a cafe's bookless, but claim with freedom, cheese, flowers and the moon, who could not be happy? That is a place, Thea, that you need to visit.
I think it's my home.
It is your spiritual home. So thank you, Tracy, for that. Here's our special podcast offer for any of you listeners. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, then go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19 and you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. Right, this week, who owns England? A good question asked by Nick Groom, this week reviewing 2 books that ponder the fate of the British countryside. Can we live in a country which has natural beauty and a fair distribution of housing? He will tell us. We then shift eastwards as we have a special edition of the paper focusing on Asia and Japan in particular. Damien Flanagan will tell us about the life and work of Mishima, and En Liang Kong will talk us through the cultural phenomenon that is manga. The idea of the British countryside is sepia-tinted with nostalgia. There's always an idyllic past upon which to reflect, a time when the brooks ran clear and the soul was solaced by the beauty of the natural world. It's preserved in literature too. Nick Groom this week quotes George Orwell's Coming Up for Air, for example, but I'm fond of the land descriptions of a similar vintage in the novels of John Buchan, filled as they are with the robust sense of the sheer generosity of the environment. How much this has been a mirage for decades perhaps doesn't matter. Groom reviews 2 books that both provide manifestos for reclaiming the countryside. Dieter Helm's Green and Prosperous Land is guardedly optimistic and suggests that we should make a virtue of the urban fantasy of the rural world to ensure that there is a place preserved worth a tourist visiting. Guy Shrubsole's approach is more journalistic and asks the question, who owns England? It has a predictably depressing answer. Half of the country is the property of just 36,000 people. And while we see record levels of homelessness, there remain 60,000 empty houses in England. The depredation of land has a history going back at least to William the Conqueror, of course, and has continued to the present day. Can it be reversed? And can that process come with a net benefit to the environment? Nick Groom is not as pessimistic as he might be and hopes for a place in which we should all be entitled to breathe the fresh air of green spaces and the countryside. Is this a utopian dream? We will ask him. Nick Groom joins us now. Nick, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's good to be talking to you, Steve.
Nick, before we get to the optimism, how bad is the current situation, in your view, when it comes to the state of the countryside?
Well, I think that, as you say, for centuries, the countryside has really been a political football. And it's been represented and, in fact, misrepresented in culture through the arts. The whole vogue of the picturesque and the pastoral was really a way of making the countryside look like it was, certainly beautiful, but also inefficient and indigent and in need of improvement. So that therefore became a justification, a rationale for privatization through enclosure. So things have been bad for a long time, and it's getting much, much worse. But I must say, having read Dieter Helm's book, I'm much less pessimistic than I was this time a month or two ago.
So what are his ideas for changing things? They're relatively small, lots of small things, aren't they?
They are lots of small things. First of all, he's an economist. I think that conservationists and those who are see themselves as protectors of the environment have generally been very suspicious of economists who, obviously are putting a price on things. But I think that he's really arguing that we have to really make these arguments as economic arguments and come up with ways of valuing and quantifying the environment, because otherwise, it's the only game in town. We're not going to be able to take those issues into account if we don't. So he comes up, he says we have to embrace these arguments, and the way to do so is to think about the overall cost. So really his mantra, if you like, is make the polluter pay. And that's not just big agri-business corporations, but that goes right down to the domestic level as well. So we need to be aware of the overall environmental impact of the way that we lead our lives, whether that's using air freshener or whether it's in terms of industrialized farming and the sort of ways in which livestock and crops are produced in this country.
It's such a good point generally, that, I think, isn't it? Because we can all have great ideas about the environment, but we never really consider the cost of having a log fire or driving an extra mile or putting some disinfectant down the sink. We can kind of live free from consequence, particularly if we live in the city, can't we?
Well, precisely. And I think that we cocoon ourselves from those effects. And as with a lot of environmental thinking, and it's the big picture that's important here. And the fact that there are chains of causation, and we do have potentially a huge impact on the environment. We have done for centuries, and humans, particularly in this country, have shaped and moulded and exploited the natural environment, but have also, of course, invested it with memories, with identity, with culture, and it is a raw material.
And in fact, I was going to say that part of it, the kind of the emotional investment, I know historically that's been the stronger tool used by conservationists. I suppose I'm wondering whether, to what extent are people moved by the economic arguments? Is Dieter Helm writing this book sort of for governments or for the public?
But I think he's writing this one for the public, although of course he does, as chair of the National Capital Committee, he's an advisor on natural capital, such as forests and minerals, rivers and so forth. But it's very difficult to quantify beauty. It's very difficult to make an economic argument for a view, for a scenic view, or for the sense of well-being you get from going for a walk in the countryside. But we have to do that. I mean, that's the argument that he's really promoting here, that it is difficult, but that's the challenge that we face.
But the argument is presumably also that we can't remove the impact of man from the environment, therefore we've just got to make it work. I'm struck by both his suggestions, and there's a couple of lines in your piece which make me think you agree that you don't like the idea of rewilding, the idea of trying to artificially return something to nature. We've almost got to accept that we're going to be sending tourists to these places. We've got to make that work rather than try and create an ideal that's not possible.
We have to make it work, and one of Helm's arguments is that farming is such a small part of GDP these days. Tourism contributes 10 times more to the economy. And so in that sense, we should be recognizing the value of outdoor pursuits. But although it's difficult to quantify, you can't quantify the intangible, the immaterial, but it's nevertheless, we've got to come up with ways of actually trying to include this in the economic assessment. It has to encompass that, you know, the human side of the environment and the way that we have shaped it, the way that it is part of our lives and our cultures, and of course, part of our future as well. And so that's really the challenge that he sets up for us. In terms of rewilding, I mean, yes, it's he's certainly very suspicious of, you know, turning the countryside into a safari park full of all sorts of charismatic, exotic creatures, as I am as well. I think that the argument has to be much more domestic in terms of how we think about uplands. For example, I mean, he's talking about overgrazing in the Lake District, which has had a detrimental effect on the environment. But I think that one of the areas in which I would question his argument is the fact that this needs to be much more locally sensitive. So near where I live, for example, on Dartmoor, undergrazing is the problem, and that's led to this outbreak of bracken, which is a, you know, very sort of invasive and monocultural form of foliage. So I think that it's important not to have too much of a top-down approach to this. We need to be much more locally sensitive.
Yeah, I think what you describe in Dartmoor is the same where I live in the Sussex Downs. The need for sheep grazing is quite clear to see, which I suppose brings me to the point that for all the small amount that farming may contribute to our GDP, it's also farming that makes our country look like it, our countryside look like it looks, and makes it appealing to the tourists.
It's rather ironic that it's enclosure, it's a patchwork.
Yeah.
Through the privatisation of common land in many places. So it shows that within a few generations, what is sort of seen as a grand theft from the rural labouring classes is then sort of seen as something which is aesthetically pleasing.
And I suppose it also goes to show the enormity of the thing that we're dealing with here, because you can't just change a small part of it. You've got to take the thing to its logical conclusion. So if you're going to support, if you're going to allow farming to continue to preserve the way that our landscape looks, then you need to find people who will eat local produce, and eventually you end up getting to the end of the line, which is supermarkets.
Well, what I find convincing about Dieter Helm's argument is that this more sentimental version of the countryside is a money spinner. And if we were more alive to that, I mean, certainly over the past, I've been a staunch defender of particularly smaller farms, and thinking about not sentimentalising the landscape. And, you know, where are the poems about, you know, castration rings and so forth? I mean, there aren't many of those. Although there are a couple of poets, some Jack Thacker, Joss Smith, who are, I think, much more alive to that these days. You know, Helm's argument is, you know, across the whole of the country, I think it's persuasive in terms of, you know, we need to rethink our relationship with the countryside. You know, why do we go there? Why do we value it? And therefore, you know, what sort of price can we put on it?
Well, let's move on to the other book, because that's probably slightly more depressing in some ways, the Guy Shrubsole book, Who Owns England. Is land ownership a problem in this country that has been there forever?
Well, he certainly argues that it's been there since at least the Norman Conquest. And he takes that very long view and encompasses certainly enclosure, as I've mentioned, and also rebellions against that, such as the diggers, for example, in the mid-17th century, in which, you know, communal gardening becomes an act of resistance, which I think we should all bear in mind next time we go weeding in the garden. But I think that it's a very invigorating book. Yes, it is dark in terms of the revelation that, you know, half of the land in England is owned by only 36,000 landowners, and how difficult it is to actually try to penetrate the corners of land and property ownership. But he's doing so, and that's what's invigorating about it. You know, through freedom of information, and frankly through Trespass, which is, you know, that this is a great book for the armchair activist. To follow him through his various trespasses. And,
well, he has to, doesn't he? Because, as you say, only 10% of England and Wales is actually open to the public.
Which is extraordinary, because we all touted the right to roam, and, you know, there is this assumption that it's much more than that, but in fact that's not the case. Other writers have looked at this as well. I mean, sort of Paul Kingsnorth, for example, about the privatisation of public spaces in towns and cities as well as in the countryside. So many places that you think ought to be open and are in fact privately owned and policed by private security firms as well.
The trick that he wants us to play, and indeed this is probably the Green New Deal argument as well that we've discussed on this podcast before, which is at a time when you have to start changing things like economic inequality, things like the housing crisis, which is there's not enough properties available for people who need them. As you say, there's 60,000 empty houses. Can we look after the economics and at the same time make strides in improving the environment? Or is it almost the decision where we can have economic benefit but not environmental, or environmental but not economic?
That's a very interesting point. I guess that you have to think about social issues and in terms of things like housing for people. I mean that's absolutely crucial. I mean there is an element of a social responsibility here, but the Shrubsfeld is certainly alive to the environmental benefits. And again, it's quite a gradualist approach that he's offering. It's a series of small changes. But, I mean, he believes very much in conservation and access. It's access and giving communities a stake in the land and therefore encouraging them to take that ownership and to preserve it, look after it, cultivate it and sustain it themselves. So I think that there is a positive aspect to this. I mean, both of them, both these writers, want us to leave the environment in general as a better place. So they are both looking towards a future here.
Is it just to end where we began? Is nostalgia dangerous, do you think, Nick? Because in some ways, nostalgia has provided a boost for an entire publishing industry in terms of nature writing and getting back to the wild. And
also swayed a massive vote quite recently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we are a nation of nostalgic people. Is that unhealthy, do you think? You quote Orwell, I think of those John Buchan books. If we're constantly looking over our shoulder and thinking, oh, there was once a time when, there was lots of leafy land and people were striding around happily and freely. Is that dangerous, do you think?
Well, I think the reason why I quote Orwell is to show that people were thinking in this way in the 1930s. And people have obviously been thinking about it for centuries. The countryside almost by its very nature, I don't want to use too many puns here, but it is formed by nostalgia, by memories, by its relationship to heritage. It's imbued with that collective meaning. I think that nostalgia and a reliance on the past can be abused when it's used to really justify or add a sort of allure to particular practices or customs or attitudes. Heritage is really about the future. It's not about the past. It's about where we go on to next, taking the values that we wish to really bequeath to our children and grandchildren, and looking forward. So we can use the environment as a great, I mean, I've called it it's like a green library, it's a heritage site. But we need to be selective about that and not just become misty-eyed about the past, but actually become clear-sighted about the future.
That's a good way to leave it. Nick Green, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Steve.
Thea, I was going to ask you, you're now a country lady, a landed lady. I mean, there was a whole conversation we had a long time ago about you being a feudal lady.
Let's not go back to that.
No. I do give up those things with such reluctance. But the has your behaviour attitudes changed? Because you've moved sort of into the Sussex Downs. Has it affected you?
Yeah, I'm able to buy locally in a way that I wasn't before. So that was my point about supermarkets and how you sort of can't just change one small thing. If you're going to kind of try to insert yourself into your surroundings and minimise the damage that you cause to it, it's a very simple way of doing that, and it's just to support small local farmers as opposed to the massive agribusiness ones.
Yeah.
The point of that pay, the polluter pays thing, is that the question is always who's going to pay, and will these huge agribusinesses ever actually pay for the damage that they do, or will it just be like the huge tech firms who pay a suspiciously small amount of tax?
I can afford in any event to pay more than they ever will do.
Yeah, exactly.
They cause more damage than they pay. It's just interesting that we've had a couple of pieces that are more optimistic than lived experience would suggest, because that Green New Deal thing we talked about was kind of weirdly optimistic.
Yeah.
And Nick Greenwood doesn't strike me as a particularly sort of, you know, head in the clouds man.
No, and it's interesting that in both cases, it's sort of, it's quite compelling, this idea of a return to the old ways being, in a sense, modernization.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you're going back to the old ways of living where, you know, where you bought locally, where you had a clearer sense of your impact, all of those sorts of things. That's motivating factor in both of them.
But will it happen? Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, you've got to hope it will.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I'm not sure human nature's like that. I just think human nature in the end is...
It takes strong, visionary governments. And there aren't very many of those.
I think we're not going to get one, I would think, in a long time.
No.
All right, we killed the mood. Well done.
I tried.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I must admit, if you say manga to me, all I can think of is the violent and exceedingly sexualized Japanese anime versions of original comic strips shown on Italian TV in the early 90s, including Sailor Moon, about an unnaturally buxom schoolgirl superhero who, with the help of a magical brooch and a gang of equally superhuman friends, must save the solar system, and Mira Ishiro, known here, I think, as Attacker U. Does that ring any bells?
Not to me.
I think that's what it was
called. Don't bring us into your mad Italian childhood of weirdness. We all know what Italian TV's like.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that these ones were imported into Italy. Anyway, so Mira Ishiro is about some really, really brutal and fraught volleyball matches, none of which seem particularly
suitable. I kind of worry about your childhood, actually. What was the dog thing? The dog
Wishbone,
in Jane Austen?
That was American.
Yeah, okay.
And that was excellent. Okay. I will hear no badness about that. That was my introduction to manga. I mean, I'm assuming that there is more to it than that. I mean, there almost certainly is. And indeed, you would have to hope so, because the August British Museum in London is currently, until August 26th, home to what is being billed as the largest exhibition of manga ever to take place outside of Japan. En Liang Kong went along to review the exhibition for us, and he joins us now to share some thoughts. Hello, En Liang.
Hi.
How do we define manga precisely? I mean, in Japan, doesn't it just mean comics? Whereas elsewhere now here, it sort of denotes specific Japanese style of comic.
Yeah, so I think this is one of the central difficult strands running through the exhibition, because it has an immediate history, and then it has an even more kind of an ancient history. So manga, like, literally means pictures running riot.
That's great.
That's
isn't
a lovely. Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Lovely.
And the curator Nicole Coolidge Rosmanier, she's able to, in the British Museum show, is able to look back at its most immediate roots. So that's sometimes in the 19th century, when you have sort of Western expat artists beginning to intermingle with local artistic traditions. You know, it's very much a form born of opening up to the world.
Really?
And sometimes, you know, very politically charged. So the arrival of Walt Disney into occupied Japan was a formative influence, apparently, for Tezuka Osamu, who's now known as the god or godfather of manga, and he created Astro Boy in the 1950s, this android orphan sort of looking for peace and justice in this cruel world.
But the exhibition argues that manga it predates that, because you could trace it back to Hokusai's great wave.
I think it's careful around that, and the way I describe it is presenting a story of art history as like clashing collage rather than talking about direct lineage. So yes, the term itself you can date into the 18th century. So it's used to describe Hokusai's sort of wild sketches of street life and myths. Terms also used by the sort of this woodblock printing culture in the 18th century, again sort of narrating the life of Yukio-e, which is this floating world, sort of seedy floating world of courtesans and playboys and actors. So it does have that art historical trace, and the show is sort of brilliantly curated in the sense that it's sharply curated in the sense that it's drawing connections between things that you wouldn't have thought evident.
To us, it's manga is presented back to us in the West as very Japanese, almost kind of a distillation of Japanese culture. It's interesting that it actually is born in its current form from an intermingling of West meeting East.
Yeah, but there is also that intermingling. You know, even in sort of Western sort of graphic novel traditions, Frank Miller, his work has been very, very influenced by manga as well. So it has always had that that kind of cross-cultural flow. And also, you know, even if you think about sort of living in the age of the Marvel franchise and in the age of sort of this golden age of comic book time, basically governing a lot of pop culture at the moment. You know, of course, that has its sort of mythical and art historical roots in the Western tradition as well, of course. Yeah.
And was this exhibition full of flashbacks for you? Did you grow up reading much manga?
It wasn't full of flashbacks in the sense that I did grow up reading manga on a few sort of summer childhood spent in Singapore or sort of in Asia. But I had a very strange introduction to manga for some reason, which escapes me
was
now.
Was it as strange as mine?
Not quite as strange.
Go on. I'll be the judge of
that. I got really into Salaryman manga, which is this genre of manga which narrates the life of like middle management Japan and the kind of like
that
daily
cool.
tribulations of people trying to work their way up the corporate ladder.
It sounds like Dilbert, you know, that,
yeah.
that long running cartoon.
Yeah, but entirely serious.
Oh, really serious?
Yeah, there's no gag involved.
Oh, right.
So you're just sitting there reading serious cartoons about middle management.
And this particular one, which is called Salaryman Kosakoshima, the character's become a celebrity in Japan, so he endorses beer and it's sold millions and millions of copies, and he presents good Japanese values. He's very humble and...
Because
you know.
I'm interested in that, because to me, when Thea talks about her unnaturally buxom schoolgirl manga to me, as someone who's not experienced it, I think of sex and violence and it being a kind of really quite creepy blend of the two. So often very sexualized violence or very violent sex. Is that my misjudgment, or is that how some of it's been presented back to Western culture? Where, am I completely wrong about that?
Well, I think the you know, obviously the exhibition is careful to sort of stray away from the more sexualized kind of manga, and the catalogue that accompanies the show is actually much more explicit about looking at the relationship between erotic woodblock printing shunga and its manifestations in different kinds of manga, and actually in the way it has some representations of abuse and you know, the female body have become much more aggressive, and the male gaze is much more of a thing in contemporary manga. But the point is also that it's, you know, that's just one of many different genres that you know, the Salaryman manga, the robot the giant smashing robot manga, the sports manga, all of these are you know, will sell millions of copies. They have their own, you know, own walls and their own fans. So
you sort of go out and choose kind of which strand you want to get into, I suppose. It's probably the hypersexual stuff. Wasn't there kind of progressive relaxing of censorship in Japan in the 90s? So possibly that's when that flourished.
And there have been works that have, have sought to, you know, break the boundaries of, you know, what's considered sexually acceptable in Japan, especially dealing with like homoerotic love as well. And so that's been foregrounded in the curation of the show.
I was reading the Watchmen book, the graphic novel, and the person who wrote that said he tried to create in Watchmen this moment of introspection about comics. It was all about comics exploring their origins. But he said the lesson that people took from it was darkness and violence. And he said, if you look at all the comics that followed Watchmen and Frank Miller's Batman series doing the same thing, it was all about violence and darkness. Whereas actually the intent of the book or the original comics was to be much more thoughtful than that. But the legacy was just, oh, violence it can be drawn in this way. And I wonder whether we've got people have an oversimplified view of manga because that's just the one thing that's felt to have had cultural impact over here.
I also think that you're doing something very different to manga and to comic books when you begin to put it into, when you put it into the white cube, when you put it into glass vitrines, you're no longer reading them in the intimate space of your home. And you're actually just less invested in narrative because I went to the show and I didn't really know like half of the stories that, you know, available on display. And you're really made to, I think the show is like really making you consider the detail, the grammatical structures of the coded meaning that run through these images. And to take the hand-drawn line that's still so important in manga, to take that seriously, to take these as, you know, serious creative artistic works as well, not just an addictive storyline that you consume in private.
And do you have a sense of whether that is how people tend to see it in Japan? I mean, is it a high form, a low form? Is it both? Does it not really fit into one or the other? Who reads it? Does it matter how old you are?
No, I mean, wouldn't say that's a reason for treating it as a high art or also low art. I mean, it makes me think of, there was a show 2 years ago at House of Illustration, which focused on the backgrounds of anime. So looking at the painstakingly crafted watercolor layouts and urban backgrounds that you find in across sort of Japanese anime films. And the curator, when he went to Tokyo to sort of try and source these products, the artist behind him thought he was completely crazy. You know, like, why on earth would you want to put this into a museum? And I'm sure lots of the artists here are similarly sort of bemused that their work is on show at like an august institution like the British Museum. But, you know, treating it as high art, or looking at it, taking time basically to look at how it functions, why it immerses you, that's the, I guess, the benefit of bring it into something like a museum or a gallery space.
Is it beautiful? I mean, are the moments where, because that's in the real test of all visual art, really, at some level, isn't it? I mean, are you walking around saying, these are moments of beauty, these are moments of created beautiful drawings?
Yes, and so in some watercolour sketches, there's a beautiful series of gouache and paper layouts for Saito Takao's 1967 Muyo no Sokuke, this bounty hunter watching this fight breaking out between two warriors on horseback, and, you know, the expressive colour of the sky, the sort of black screech marks that appear when the horse, you know, it's a wonderfully evocative scene. Also, I mean, I think your eye is just nonetheless drawn to the historical pieces that are on display. So there's this amazing 17 meter stretch long length of curtain, this theatre curtain, created in the 19th century by Kawanabe Kiyosai, created while he was like completely steaming drunk from several bottles of sake.
The best way to create, surely.
Yes.
But it's really, you know, it's these possessed theatrical costumes that leap out of their boxes, really spooky. So, you know, I suppose it's easier for the eye to be more immediately drawn to the art historical connections that are being created out of this. But I think what I was most drawn to in terms of these works, like capacity for beauty, is the ability to do things, without text, to evoke emotions, to evoke experiences, without saying anything explicitly. that is something that you know, manga has real potential for, because it has this you know, this coded system of symbols that, you know, once you're kind of immersed in that world, you begin to recognize. This amazing strip of this saxophonist cartoon, Shinichi Ishizuka's Blue Giant Supreme, and you know, when he begins to play, the entire background of the strip begins to turn into this like strange astral sort of rain, and you see those sort of double basses twanging away, these like, huge sort of thud marks like leaping across the page. And there's a really fantastic essay in the catalogue where the scholar Itago talks about how strange this is with musical manga. He says, readers become the listening audience, expanding their imagination while manga artists play inaudible sounds. You know, that's the sort of fantastic thing about an image like that, that, you know, we're all seeing the same image, but presumably we're hearing completely different music.
I think I'm going to have to go along.
Yeah, we've got time.
Yeah.
Is it air-conditioned?
I'll be all right either way.
It's cool.
Yeah,
it's cool.
This heat's not bothering you.
No, it's perfect.
Oh, for God's sake. We're never going to agree on that. Let's agree on manga, but not on that. And Nian Kong, thank you very much
thank
indeed.
Thank you very much.
Kimitake Hiraoka was 19 when he feigned illness to avoid conscription in 1944 and probable death in combat. He survived to be a chronicler of the existential angst of post-war Japan, adopting the pen name of Yukio Mishima and becoming a literary darling of the 1950s. This wunderkind produced best-selling serialized stories and plays, and then was tempted by the world of film acting. He dreamed of becoming the Thomas Mann of modern Japan and the Japanese James Dean. Damien Flanagan charts the life of a man who, as well as writing, threw himself into the roles of photographic model, film producer, stage director, political activist, and finally, fatally, leader of his own private army. And that was just the 1960s. In 1970, he killed himself by ritual disemboweling. Who was this figure who has a 42-volume complete works? Well, Damien has read two new translations of relatively minor works, Star and The Frolic of the Beasts. He can tell us more about Mishima now. Damien, hello.
Hi.
What should we begin to know about him, both in terms of his life and style? What are the first thing that comes to your mind that people should know about him?
Mishima was a master of language, I think, first and foremost. He writes in the most incredibly beautiful Japanese. He's a master stylist, and I think it's a challenge for every translator to convey that beauty in a foreign language. One of Mishima's great themes is the subject of beauty itself, of how beauty impacts on human beings. And because he's so interested in that subject, I mean, he talks in his in some of his works as aesthetic terrorism of beauty actually almost attacking you and overwhelming you. So I think the great challenge for any translator is to try and convey something of that felicity with words that Mishima has. But he's also a man of fascinating, almost unique themes. I think Mishima probed uncomfortable areas of the psyche that few other authors dared to go. He was probes into the kind of murderous instincts within human beings, sadomasochism, suppressed sexuality. And he's a great intellectual figure. He's borrowing from ideas from all over the world, vastly well read at university. He'd actually studied German law and could read fluently in German, but was also extremely interested in what was happening in the English language speaking world, fascinated by as diverse countries as India and what was going on in China and Southeast Asia. So I think you're talking about a combination of, in his writing, someone of enormous intellect mixed in with someone with a tremendous technical capacity for writing, which means you're dealing with a major literary figure.
How did this come about? What was his childhood like? I don't think he lived in a particularly literary family, did he?
Well, he had a very unique and peculiar childhood. He was descended from a family, a bit of a mixed family, that on one side had sort of aristocratic connections, on another side was quite humble, but had come up in the 19th century when Japan had modernized. His father's side of the family was sort of rising stars in the new order of modern Japan and sort of married into the more aristocratic side. But it had all gone badly wrong when his grandfather, who had actually been governor of a province, of a newly acquired province of what's now Sakhalin, owned by Russia, had been involved in a scandal. And the family had gone from being very prominent to essentially being faded glory. His grandmother was very indignant, who'd been from the aristocratic side, was very indignant about what had happened to the family. And she was sort of determined that the new generation, her grandson, would revive the family fortune. She'd been quite disappointed in her son's performance. So when Kimitake, which is Yukio Mishima's real name, was born, she essentially took the child from the parents and said, I'm going to raise this child myself. So Kimitake was quite a sickly child, and his grandmother was also quite sickly. And she wanted to prevent as much as possible the child going outside. She was very worried about his health and wanted to keep him quite close to her and also to nurse her. So what this meant was his early childhood was very much kept indoors, and he was prevented from playing with other boys, but instead kind of lost himself in a fantasy world of books. She was a regular theatre goer. She liked to go to traditional forms of Japanese theatre like kabuki, which tends to be often quite outlandish plots and quite violent. And he absorbed all this great theatrical interest from her, and also got used to being in the confined space of her bedroom and absorbing all the reading material around him. So when he wrote his famous sort of breakout book, published in 1949, Confessions of a Mask, he talks in a kind of lightly fictionalized manner, but mostly autobiographical, of all these different books and influences that he was reading as a child that were really feeding this imagination. So it becomes from the very earliest years that the sort of world of the imagination and fantasy becomes stronger in the child's mind than the actual reality outside. And this becomes one of the great themes of Mishima, of the interaction and tensions between imagination and reality.
And then in the 50s, you talk about that breakout book in 1949. In the 50s, he writes things that are recognised as classics, but he's also a massive bestseller. He's producing books that are presumably seen as sort of populist light works. By the time he's getting to the end of the 1950s, what sort of figure is he in Japan? Just the superstar author? Is that where he gets to?
That's right. He's from an early age. Mishima and his father had always opposed his writing ambitions because he wanted his son to be like a bureaucrat in the family tradition. And Mishima had always had to sort of covertly write as a young child and sort of prove to his father. And there's a famous anecdote that goes when his father finally agreed to his son stopping his bureaucratic career. He actually worked as a bureaucrat briefly in his early 20s. The famous anecdote goes, his father looks at him and says, well, make sure you're the most famous writer in Japan then. And I think Mishima took this very, very literally. He wanted to be, when he achieved fame with Confessions of a Mask, he'd already written extensively before then, but it hadn't received great popularity previously. But when he finally achieves that success in his early 20s, he's determined that he will keep on building from there, and that he wants to carry on producing great literary works. But he also wants to, he's extremely in tune with what's happening at the time. Japan was greatly westernizing, picking up American influences. The country is very much in a period of transition in that post-war period. And he's very alert to that, wants to himself keep changing, moving forward. And he shows that he's equally adept at writing extremely popular works that will sell in the hundreds of thousands for women's magazines and other popular outlets like that, as well as keeping building on this very strong literary reputation. And he didn't just write novels. He was also writing plays, both in the Western and Japanese traditions. He very often said he's one of the few writers, possibly the only writer in post-war Japan, who could write traditional kabuki plays that actually sounded like proper kabuki plays, because he'd so mastered the language of those plays. He also revived the no Japanese play tradition, wrote some modern no plays, and also wrote a tremendous number of short stories, memoirs, essays. So just an extraordinarily prolific figure who, by the end of the 1950s, it has a huge army of fans in Japan across many different genres. Some of the leading critics of Japan had already recognized him as an outstanding talent, and had actually said to him in interviews they'd had, you know, you are exceedingly talented. So by the time we get to the period that these two works that we're discussing today were published at the end of the 1950s, he's someone who is nationally famous and has already a very high literary reputation, even though he's only in his early 30s.
And how were these new works received then?
Well, I think the because Mishima wrote so much, these are just, I think, works that are a part of a vast repertoire for Mishima. I mean, Star, which is his fascinating sort of fictional insight into his experience of the movie-making industry, is not a work that's well-known in Japan. But it's fascinating that you can take what a work that's kind of buried in his complete works, and you can discover it to be completely fascinating in its own right. It's almost like you've got so many treasures in the complete works that some of the smaller diamonds tend to be missed. But when you pull them out and look at them in isolation, you can think, well, that really is interesting in its own right. But generally tends not to get the attention it might get otherwise, because he had so many other large-scale works, such as The Temple of the Golden Pavilion or The Sound of Waves, or many works such as that, which were getting attention.
You mentioned his suppressed sexuality in the books and in his own life. He was gay. How openly could that manifest itself kind of in his life, and therefore how much did it manifest itself in the books, do you think?
I think in 1950s Japan and the West, I think it was very much homosexuality, I think, tended to be thought of a characteristic which almost like a sort of bad habit that you could train yourself out of if you put your mind to it. So that it wasn't something that was necessarily regarded as innate and unalterable. It was regarded as something that, in the manner of Mishima, for example, had started off with quite a weak physical body, and he took it into his head that he was going to get himself a strong body, and he took up various physical exercises such as boxing and martial arts, and eventually bodybuilding, and transformed his body physically. And he also felt that if he dedicated it to himself to it, he could also, to a large extent, manage to adapt himself sexually as well. So although he admitted that he didn't really enjoy physical acts with the opposite sex, he felt he could sort of train himself that if he went out with a woman, he could eventually get used to this. And in, for example, in 1958, he got married and he subsequently had two children. But I don't think there's really any doubt that Mishima was, in reality, pretty much a completely gay man who was just having to sort of force himself to go through these motions. Mishima was attracted to the idea that he could kind of put up a respectable facade to society. He wanted to have a family unit, a wife. His marriage was in some ways a successful one because his wife supported him. They seemed to get on well together. And he wanted to have children. I think what he had to do sexually was increasingly hide his sexuality, certainly from the eyes of the general public and anyone that he didn't think would readily be understanding of it. It's interesting that in his early works, Confessions of a Mask, he seems to be like coming out as a gay man. It's for, I think, many gay people, it's an iconic work that people are very grateful that he wrote such a wonderfully frank account of his own sexuality. But bizarrely, it was actually treated as fiction. I mean, his own family dismissed it as a load of nonsense.
Well, his dad sort of had an absolute fear of any effeminacy, didn't he? Sort of.
That's right. And
the problem I think with him, he's got this 42 volumes of his complete works, David. We could spend the next hour talking about.
It could be a fixed segment on every show.
Can we do another bit more? We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. We've run out of time. But thank you so much. What a fascinating figure, and you've brought these two books to life in the paper and talked much more about everything else there. So, Damien Flanagan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
We actually have an extract from A Late Story by Mishima, translated by Stephen Dodd in this week's TLS. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Nick Groom, Damien Flanagan and N. Liang Kong. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. This week has lots in it. Next week, there will be poetry and an attack on the American justice system. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.